Hey everyone, and welcome to Chef AJ Live. I'm your host, Chef AJ, and this is where I introduce you to amazing people like you who are doing great things in the world that I think you should know about. Back by popular demand, my guest today is a wonderful plant-based dietitian named Deepa Deshmukh. I knew we practiced it before. I said it right, and then I blew it. Anyway, we just call her Dietitian Deepa, but she's going to be talking about the role of ethnic dietary patterns to combat chronic conditions. Please welcome her back to the show. Nice to see you again. I enjoyed meeting you at the Plantrician Conference, and I so enjoyed your presentation.
Of course, thank you so much, Chef AJ, for having me back and having wonderful conversation at Plantricious Conference. So glad to be here. And today's topic is very near and dear to my heart because it's all about the role of ethnic dietary patterns to combat chronic conditions and how to harness cultural foods as superfoods. So to get started, let me just start by kind of giving you a bit overview of how I landed learning more about these cultural foods and the importance of it in my practice. So what had happened is I started my private practice in 2006, and around 2008, I also started working at a FQHC, Federally Qualified Healthcare Facility, which serves the underserved population. So the population that I was serving had ethnic of different ethnic backgrounds, like Polish, Ethiopian, Hispanics, Nepalese, of course, Asian Indians and Pakistani and Middle Eastern, South American, African Americans, Koreans, etc. So that kind of propelled me into this space, and what I thought was very fascinating was the similarities that we have in terms of food and cultural beliefs with this population. As an immigrant, I was able to relate to what they were going through. So there was a synergy between what I was doing and what I was offering and what the population wanted. So I'm going to go through a bit of a storytelling style of presentation today, starting with my typical patient like Stella. So Stella is a 64-year-old Hispanic woman diagnosed with type 2 diabetes and with weight issues and blood pressure, diagnosis of blood pressure as well. She lives with her husband and kids in a multi-generational families, we call it, which is very common in among underserved and ethnically diverse populations. She works full-time, and the important thing here to notice is that she wants to change and wants to feel good. So we it was safe to say that Stella was a motivated person to make the change. So Stella, would come to this busy clinic, and as you know, most doctors have 15 minutes per visit, and they have been given this responsibility of to nudging the patient to make a lifestyle change. So then Stella, or patients like Stella, they get this 15-minute visit. During this visit, they get a prescription, basically. So Stella's treatment plan could include a oral hypoglycemic agent or an other medication adjustment, generic handout on diet, and maybe and most of the time it's just translated in Spanish, and she's given a flyer to join a wellness program, and a referral to a RD. Now we know that we have a there is a systemic shortage of dietitians and diabetes care education specialists, and the shortage is even more if of whole food plant-based practicing RDs and diabetes care education specialists. So, but I was fortunate to have been employed by this particular FQSC. And but again, even as a dietitian, I just got 15-minute visit with the dietitian and was given a task of changing Stella's lifestyle. So, and it wasn't like, you know, Stella got out of her doctor's office or that room and came directly to my room. No, there was a lag of at least 6 to 8 weeks because the clinic is so busy. So meanwhile, what happens is, what should Stella do? I mean, she gets all kinds of advice. She goes home and she remembers that her doctor said, oh, Stella, lose 20 pounds, lower your blood glucose, watch carbs, don't eat fried foods. Then when she saw the nurse said, well, eat protein, try some meal kits, avoid carbs. Her endocrinologist also kind of said the same thing, watch carbs, eat fruits and salads and avoid red meat and soda. And then depending on which RD CDCS she ends up with, it's so many diets, and these dietitians also promote so many different diets. I mean, that's a problem in itself, that the lack of consensus on what is a evidence-based diet that we should provide for chronic disease management. But depending on that, you know, she may hear a nutritionist or dietitian saying vegan, paleo, or her mom would say, oh, Stella, you know, no matter what you do, you are going to end up with insulin. And even her vet has an opinion about what she should do, which is, hey, eat oatmeal and salads during the week and cheat on the weekends. So so you can imagine what Stella must be going through, or patients like Stella, they go through this confusion. So then when Stella comes back after 6 weeks, doctor may say, or she gets labeled as poor, like, you know, non-compliant or poor compliance. And Stella is feeling all guilty. And she feels, oh, I give up. Nothing is working. I'm an emotional eater. It's my fault. You know, all this stuff. So eventually, after a few weeks, maybe a couple months, Stella ends up in my room. And now here I'm having like dietitian's dilemma here, you know, that I have 15 minutes, my schedule is double booked. And this is a live, this is a real picture of how our classroom used to look. And I'm going to talk more about this. But I, as you can see here, in 15 minute visit, I had to serve a very diverse population of patients with special needs, or special population of pregnant women and elderly and special needs, and had to, both patients and myself had to come over the language barriers that they have, the limited resources they have, literacy issues, and a lot of them had competing priorities, shift work, families to take care of, multi-generational homes, lack of transportation. So I always felt, oh my God, so much to do. I mean, how can I take this person from point A to point Z? And all that, I mean, we all know that the behavior change is, or making change to one's food habits, it's not a straight line. I mean, we fall off the wagon. I mean, we are swimming against very strong forces of food industry and pharmaceutical industry. So this dilemma as to how do I resonate these people in those 15 minutes? There's so much to do, so little time. So that kind of got me thinking into, you know, creating strategies or tools that I could use to kind of help these people along the journey. And it was around the same time, there was a tremendous rise in the idea of superfoods and fall of ethnic foods, I felt. I was noticing that my patient population that I just showed you, even though they were having strapped for resources, they would walk in the office with some supplements and like turmeric supplements and expensive packs of green tea and mushrooms and extra virgin olive oil and grass-fed meats and all these things, and kind of were drifting away from their traditional ethnic foods like rice and potato and corn, millets, ethnic vegetables, herbs and spices, which were so easily available in their local grocery store. So this focus on individual superfood versus focusing on dietary pattern was becoming very obvious to me. And one thing I noticed was when people started focusing, they continue to do even now, is, you know, once you start focusing on a single superfood, it gives you a false sense of, I take my turmeric tablet or supplement, I drink green tea whole day, so I can sleep off and eat something what I call as off-track food. So there was so much confusion and mixed messaging about what people should eat and what they shouldn't eat, that it would just make this in my work 100 times harder, because now I have 15 minutes and I have to help these people really understand what was going on here. So nonetheless, I started noticing that, of course, the genetics plays the role, but lifestyle, like adoption of standard American diet, or what I call as DPD, disease promoting diets, high stress, circadian rhythm abnormalities, low physical activity, environmental pollutants, etc. What happened that the traditional, in this case, I have used Indian thali, which consists of grains as a majority, followed with some dal and some vegetables, some raw vegetables, and few condiments in between. That was being hijacked, I felt, by the food industry, but also by this superfood industry, you may say, you know, and that was just creating more confusion, and people were not paying attention to their core eating habits, but got stuck into the supplement and superfood craze. So a research study was done to see if the current dietary recommendations are equitable. And they found out they are not, because look at the nutrition disparity here. For heart disease and for diabetes, the incidence or these two diseases are obviously diet-driven disease conditions and affect the minority population the most. And however, the dietary recommendations in the United in US, it, I mean, that that's the official statement, that dietary recommendations in the US may be inadequate at improving the diets in racial ethnic minority communities, and therefore we must have to come up with our own tools and strategies. And this is kind of fueled and confirmed my belief that, you know, if I have 15 minutes with the patient, I have to show them what the foods from their own culture are nutritious, and they need to start eating those to get to where they want to be in terms of their health. So I kind of started creating tools, and I noticed that, you know, this one plate fits all size is not going to be the solution here. I have to create something else. And I kind of came up with this concept of my smart plate and started creating different versions based on the readiness to change. For example, in the center, you will see like a transition plate. But then I came up with a plate, smart plate with some Indian foods on in it, and Asian and Native American and African American, so on and so forth. These plates are still work in progress. I go back and forth and I change things, but you get the concept that we are not going to address this issue of combating chronic disease by just telling everybody to eat the same, not the same thing, but making these very standard recommendation because people resonate more when they hear the words or foods that their ancestors ate or prominent in their culture. I mean, many times, if not all the times, Indian patients that I see, the first thing they see, well, we decided to come to you because you are Indian. And we know that you understand our food. I mean, that's the connection right there. Then I got into the nutrient density pyramids and then, you know, changed into calorie density pyramid. But either way, these are, they satisfy the both criteria, the calorie density pyramid and nutrient density pyramid. Ended up obviously making versions based on the different ethnicities, like such as Indian, African American, Native American, Asian, so on and so forth. And what really helped, having these kind of visual tools really helped me making that 15-minute visit very impactful, because people went home seeing, noticing what is on these plates and pyramids. And I had literally so many different handouts along the same line. I'm just showing you a few here, but you can see, I mean, it's the same concept, but what was happening is when you give them the standard plate or standard pyramid, they feel that if they don't eat what's on there, everything else is, they should eliminate. So that's the confusion I was trying to avoid here. Then another initiative I got myself into was the lifestyle and wellness kitchen. So because of the amount of patients that I was that I had to see, and the knowledge deficit that I noticed, I said, you know what, this all this has to be delivered through the kitchen as a clinic platform. So the federal the FQSC, they got a grant to build this beautiful commercial kitchen, and we would and that was in 2015. I mean, almost more than almost 10 years ago now. Can't believe how much time has passed. But as you can see, I had a phenomenal team of people here. A nurse whom I trained to cook with in the kitchen, the pharmacist on the right-hand side here, Marco, who had never cooked anything with so many different vegetables and stuff. So I had phenomenal team, but the most importantly, along with opening up the lifestyle kitchen, we also collaborated with the farmer here. Oops, sorry, I finally found the laser pointer here. So it was a collaboration between the farmer who would come to our clinic every Wednesday for 20 weeks. And we had enrolled 150 families in this program. And the farmer would come at 6:30 in the morning, and I would come around 7:30 to the clinic. I would pick up whatever he had and cooked three times from 9:30, 10:30, and 11:30. We had divided these 150 families into three classes. And as you can see in the kitchen, they would come, all of us would cook. Me and my team would cook, and then the patients went home with a recipe. At the same time, they got to try what all the different fruits and vegetables from different cultures that I had worked with the farmer to grow, and a box of fruits and vegetables, and more vegetables than fruit, because we wanted to really focus on the consumption of vegetables. So this went on for almost 3 years or so. And it was a phenomenal experience. I mean, it was like we had this big, happy family where we would meet every week. And as you can see, people from different walks of life benefited from this. It was a community. It was a group work. And the program was called Fresh First Program. And as you can see here, we worked on growing. I worked with the farmer with growing different color of vegetables. Sometimes we would have color of the week, and we went through the whole eat like rainbow exercise. I mean, my most favorite week used to be the purple vegetables, because purple is my color. I love it. And just the first time when I saw the purple cabbage and this purple turnip and this special Asian purple radishes, or like daikons, but in purple color, I was so happy. I mean, it just gave me so much joy and happiness. It was like seeing your pet or a baby or something, you know. They were just instant love with that vegetable basket. Even my farmer said, "Deepa, I've never seen somebody have tears in their eyes because just by looking at the vegetables." But it just looked so beautiful, and people would be so happy and thrilled and so interested in learning about these new fruits and vegetables. It was amazing. So Fresh First Program was a success, and we'll get back to it again in a few minutes. And then again, we cooked, or I showed all different kinds of sauces and dressings and seasonings from different parts of the world, drew upon some of my experience traveling. In fact, I would also ask patients to teach, to stand and kind of talk about the foods and cultural practices, cooking techniques, etc., from their own culture. So it was very interactive, because my goal was that, you know, we learn from each other, right? And this intracultural exchange of ideas that happen, and that made people talk to each other and learn from each other. I mean, it was. I'm so grateful that I got to go through that experience. And this was just happening like an osmosis. I didn't even realize that I was absorbing all that until now, when I look back and I say, "Oh my goodness, what an opportunity that was." We did a lot of different cooking techniques as well. So I wanted to show this particular slide because when I started bringing in okra or different kind of eggplant and stuff like that, people would say, "Oh, I hate okra. You know, it's all slimy," and or "I hate mushrooms." And I would tell them, "Well, you know, how, in what form and shape did you eat?" And they would say, "Oh, you know, I'm like a gumbo, or my mom used to add it to the soup," and so on and so forth. And I said, "Well, you know, there are different techniques that you can use to take the food that you don't like and kind of try it again. We have to try something, 17 times before we conclude that we don't like something." So by showing them how to grill vegetables, I cannot tell you how many people started eating okra, and now that okra is so popular, the okra became so popular that the farmers started growing okra at a larger quantities and started supplying it to the another ethnic grocery store. I mean, that's how it propels, you know. And same thing, you know, we had some different kind of gourds, and these are just different spice mixes that I used to show them. Now, on the right hand side, you see these spice bottles here. So we gave them incentives that represented the ethnic ingredient from different ethnicities. You know, sometime it would be different kind of beans or lentils or grains. There was a Polish population that, or few Polish patients that we used to see. And when we asked them, you know, what kind of grains they use, and they said buckwheat. So we gave away packets of buckwheat, and along with the herbs and spices. So the incentives which we gave them also were closer to their cultural foods. So that being said, it really, I could see that the compliance of patients was better when they saw the similarity between what their cultural background is and what they were recommended to offer. Another interesting initiative that I'm still involved in is between the local food pantry called Murray Wilkinson's Food Pantry and Murray's Garden. Now, the community garden, the Murray's Garden is a community garden, is across from Murray Wilkinson's Food Pantry. Very convenient, a perfect location for both organizations. I mean, basically, it's Murray Wilkinson's Food Pantry owns the Murray Wilkinson's Garden, and all the produce from the garden gets passed on to the food pantry people. But again, we used to notice that, you know, if we don't tell people what these new fruits and vegetables are, they wouldn't know what to do, and it was going waste. So we started having cooking classes right in the, we call it Murray's Kitchen, which is basically a little nice workspace, like a kitchen basically, inside the community garden. And periodically we bring in groups of different ethnicities to come and visit the garden. That way they get to see what the garden is all about. They can volunteer, but most importantly, we do maybe potluck, or sometime I will cook something, literally picking up from the garden and creating a recipe. So all these initiatives are just amazing initiatives to carry. And I see the power of it. You know, these are just some success stories, and I have so many of them. But here, this particular patient, Sulu, she lost so much weight and reversed her diabetes, went off of medications, because I was able to provide her Indian focused or meals and ideas and strategies which took into account her culture, basically. Same thing with Deidre here, you know, African American person. When she was so happy when I told her she can eat corn and sweet potato and cassava root and all that, and plantains, and she was super happy because she said she has been through diets where, you know, it's again that one plate size fits all approach, and she didn't enjoy that food, so she started enjoying food. And the most recently, Lisa, who has Italian background in her, and she was on Ozempic, but she ditched the diabetes and Ozempic. How? Literally, she got enrolled in the program because I told her that she can have pasta. I mean, she said, oh my goodness, nobody has said me in a long, long time to eat pasta. So, you know, if I had, instead of pasta, if I had said, oh, you can have millet or corn, not that she would have been opposed to, but if your genetic or if your culture is all about eating rice and pasta, then, and if that is what the other person is asking you to do, you're more likely to follow it. So we understand that these cultural practices, beliefs, play a very important role in combating chronic disease, and creating that match just takes us one step closer to what we are trying to achieve here, is to improve clinical outcomes. Now, as much as I enjoyed all these things, doing this one-on-one is a challenge, because we have to be able to do this. I could reach only 400 families, but there are 1,000 more or a couple thousand more families with diabetes who need the education as we speak, or there may be literally in thousands. So I'm most excited about my new collaboration with this company called Pronex, where we are developing a turnkey solution to take all my tools and strategies that I have developed, learned over the years, to convert it and put it in this platform that lifestyle medicine practitioners can use it at scale. Because unless we have a tool where we can teach, reach, track, and support and guide our patients when they need it, when they need us the most, we cannot achieve a long-term compliance. And if there is no long-term compliance, clinical outcome are not as impactful. We have to show collectively that nutrition not only helps short-term, but also long-term, and we are making a population-wide impact. And that's how we are going to move the needle from disease to wellness. So if any lifestyle medicine practitioner wants to learn more about it, just text me at 630-686-7300, or just send me an email. But I'm super excited about this, because finally, I feel that I can help more people. As much as I enjoyed working with this group so far, I know that there are many thousands still deserve to get this information. Our job collectively is to make sure everybody has access to nutrition education, period. You know, if your doctor is telling you to have a surgery for your chronic disease, or recommending you medication, then he or she must offer nutrition as a third modality to take care of the disease. So hopefully having this tool out for lifestyle medicine practitioner will take some of the burden off of their plate, because it was very difficult for me to, my cat, jeez, for me to able to scale it. And whatever I showed you requires a lot of manpower and energy, and not all the organizations have that. And that's a problem we face. So scaling is a problem, but that's the next thing I'm planning to solve. So before I conclude, I just want to introduce this theory of melting pot versus salad bowl theory, where you know, melting pot kind of focuses on one, like a singular solution to solve the problem, but salad bowl theory is a social science theory which tells us to focus on the individuality and using food, culture, beliefs as a unique proposition of each individual, and use that to solve the complex issues that we have in our society. So that being said, that's all for today. And if there are any questions, I will take it now.
I love that melting pot versus salad bowl theory. That's very cool.
Yeah, it's a social science theory that was brought out in 1959 by this by Dr. Carl. I will have to come up. I know the name. It's just skipping my mind right now. But yeah, that because salad bowl, you know, in salad bowl you have each ingredient which brings in value. So
Oh,
I know the Karen
it's
is
beautiful.
she's Dan. She doesn't usually come here,
Oh
but
my, I love gray pets. I bet she's beautiful.
she's Russian blue. But she's very so I guess sometimes she sees if I'm very involved in my conversations, she comes and tries to get attention, I guess.
Oh.
But yeah, so the melting pot versus salad bowl theory, it really resonates with what we do because salad, you know, in salad bowl, there's every individual ingredient is important and brings different flavor and color and at the end the salad is beautiful because of that different ingredients. So that's what I have to offer to you all today.
You know, it's interesting when you talked about how it really helps when you give people the familiar foods of their culture, especially if they're making a change. But what I'm wondering, and again, everyone's different, but in some cases, if they got into trouble with maybe their weight or diabetes, was it from eating the foods of their culture or eating the foods of another culture? The reason I say that is I work a lot in Mexico, and you know, there's very high diabetes right there. And they're not eating beans and rice. They're eating at what they actually call this the American Embassy at McDonald's. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely. Because what happens is they get the message that hey, grilled chicken is good, egg whites are good, you start eating those. So they go after that messaging. I cannot tell you how many Indian patients that I have seen, those who were vegetarians, who never ate meat or eggs in their especially meat in their lives, started eating grilled chicken and egg whites because that's the message they got from whoever they were seeing, the doctor, the dietitian, whatever. So it's the messaging thing, you know, and this whole and not to mention the original cultural foods are very good, but because of the invention of oil, salt, and sugar, whatever, our cooking techniques have changed. So they have taken the rice and beans, and now it is turned into a patty and fried and is served with mayonnaise and cheese on top. So it's a combination. The easy access to DPD, disease promoting dietary choices or SAD diet, and moving away from your traditional diets, because once you have the dopamine hit with the processed food, the rice and beans doesn't taste that good in the beginning. So we are dealing with the psychological forces, biological forces, and environmental forces.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so interesting because I have some lovely Indian neighbors that have become dear friends, and they'll have us over to eat. And you know, if somebody puts a little sugar, a little salt, I don't flip out. I prefer not to have it, but I don't want to eat oil because I don't feel it's necessary. It doesn't make me feel good after all these years of not eating it. So she'll make me like idli or something, and she'll do it oil free. And then for the next ones, she'll put the oil in. And it's like, well, just a little, and I can't, I love her so much, but I can't get her to understand it's not necessary. I mean, because she made mine and it was delicious. So that oil thing is so hard, isn't it, with Indian food, especially if you want to go to an Indian restaurant.
Oh, Indian restaurant. Don't even get me started with them. But even it has. So my oldest patient, Indian patient, is 89-year-old, living in back in India. And if she can learn to cook Indian food without oil, we all can. It's all about the attitude. And sometimes I just say, don't ask, don't tell. You know, don't tell anybody that you're cooking without oil. How does it matter? People are focused on taste. And another teaching point here is to understand that all the spices have oil in them. Essential oil is a $1 billion industry. Somebody is sitting there and extracting oil out of cumin, garlic, chili, and selling it. So when you actually toast spices, or when we make that tadka, there's enough oil that nature has put in that spice to extract the flavor. So there's absolutely no need to, you know, use oil even little bit, because sometimes I have asked people, okay, put that little bit in a bottle for 1 week and let's say how little bit it was. And when I get a picture of that bottle, oh, it's half bottle. That's half a pound of oil, you know?
And that's one of the, I think when I say easiest, one of the simplest changes people can make that's going to make a difference in their weight and their diabetes. It's just, it's not food. And to get articulate that to people, even American cuisine. I mean, I went to culinary school and there's a belief that oil carries flavor. I mean, fat might carry flavor, but you don't need oil. You can still have fat. You can have avocados. You can have nuts. You can have seeds. And what they don't realize is that when you use oil, you have to use a lot more salt, because it actually, so yeah, that I think, you know, I was listening to one of Dr. McDougall's podcast, and somebody had asked him what's, you know, they've been doing this like almost 50 years too, like me, and what's the hardest thing? And one of the things they said is the eating out, because to articulate that to other people, whether you're going to their house or restaurants, it's like a deer in the headlights. They're like, well, you can't make food without oil. It's like, it's not possible. And yet look at all the wonderful chefs like Mary McDougall and Anne Esselstein and all of us that followed their guidance and make delicious food without oil.
Absolutely. And teaching that technique to my population was the biggest, what can I say, gift I got from that experience. That because, you know, when you work with underserved population where they are in a multi-generational homes, all I had to change was the habit of one person, right? And it had a ripple effect. So that gives you more satisfaction that, hey, you are changing the health of a family and not just one person. So yeah, but again, like I said, I'm very excited about this new collaboration with this Pronex company, and hoping that all this can be turned into this turnkey solution platform that the lifestyle medicine practitioners can incorporate into their existing EMR, EHR, because we are dealing with a large number of people with chronic disease. So we have to be able to scale what we do.
Absolutely. You know, there's another plant-based wonderful doctor named Dr. Wes Youngberg, and he's always said that oil is a triumph of marketing over science. And even people that are just vegans for whatever reason, there's still so much oil used in vegan restaurants, you know, veg fests, and they actually get upset when you know, like oh, they think like, oh, these oil-free people. And it's like, and it's not just about like, you don't have to necessarily have heart disease to want to avoid it. It's just, it's like once you avoid it, you learn how disgusting it actually was.
Absolutely. And then another thing is I get to see a lot of patients with diabetes who have continuous glucose monitoring systems. So they are hooked onto this machine and they can literally see how their blood is reacting to food that they eat. And every time, it's not like I want to be their police, but they become their own police, because the CGSM is now showing them, hey, you ate this particular fried samosa in the restaurant and now your blood sugar is high for next 15 hours, you know? So I'm not a big fan of all these machines and gadgets when it comes to monitoring the blood sugars and all that, because people do get fixated on that. But it's a good tool for people to see themselves, that eating a potato with the same masala that the samosa has, but just without oil, and the real samosa, which is fried and God knows what else is in there, how the blood sugars are climbing up or down. And that's a good teaching tool. And then they are like, oh, I'm not going to go to the restaurant. And I said, oh, thank God, I don't have to be a food police.
Well, that is such a misconception just in general throughout the world that diabetes is caused by sugar when it's caused by fat.
And that's the devastation to the palates that I saw with this population, because all these different ethnicities I mentioned, they all stopped eating corn or buckwheat or rice or wheat or potato. I mean, food that are core to their existence. And then they would spend money, hard-earned money, by working in two shifts to buy some mushroom powder from here and green tea from there, and you know, all those things. And I said, no, move away from superfoods to just your culturally dietary patterns. We'll work on cooking techniques, and off we go.
Well, that's one of the most important points that I think you drove home in your presentation, because the supplement and the superfood industry is now this billion-dollar industry. You know, everybody, you know, amla powder and, you know, I don't know, all these other things. Not to say that it's not healthy, but the reality is people have superfoods probably in their refrigerator and pantry right now, but because they don't have the marketing behind them,
I understand.
They're not thinking about it. Yeah. I love you. I love your sense. You have a common sense approach to this.
Yeah. The most funny thing was when my own doctor said, Deepa, you might want to start taking turmeric. I heard Indians use turmeric. And I'm looking at him, please. When we are born, the first thing that they stuck in our mouth is a paste of turmeric. You know, that since then I've been eating turmeric. I don't need the supplements. And even more ironic slash hilarious thing is, when I go to India, which is quite often, I ask people, what do they want? Now they want green tea. And somebody just asked me to get turmeric tablets, or what, cinnamon tablets. And I'm like, why? You know, why do you want me to bring you turmeric tablets when you guys are growing turmeric in your backyards? So it's very interesting how our perspective, and you know, like you said, it's all influence of marketing, and that looking for that magic pill
potion procedure.
Mm-hmm.
Are you getting a lot of clients now that are either on Ozempic or similar drugs, or want to be on it?
So we get one or two requests every week. Hey, are you prescribing Ozempic or Wegovy or what I've used? You know, and then we say, no, this is our approach. They say, oh, not interested. But then I have this one physician who does have, he does prescribe Ozempic, but at the same time, he refers his patients to me immediately to back that up with lifestyle change, and with a common goal of taking them off of it, you know. And then I get few calls from patients on their own that Ozempic is just too drastic on their digestive system, or they have gotten in trouble, a lot of health issues. So it's a combination.
Well, speaking of the digestive issues, that's what I'm hearing from a lot of the medical doctors, that some of these problems that they're having with the digestion kind of like slowing down or stopping, that may be permanent for some people.
I don't doubt it, because you have just chemically changed your, you know, system so much. So, but people are desperate.
Yep. So you mentioned you had a client in India. Now you don't live in India. So how do you work with people? If people wanted to get in touch and be either treated or coached or, you know, work with you, could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So they can, the easiest way to get to our office is the text number that I had on one of the slide. It is 630-686-7300. And they can text us their name and email, and we will guide them through the process. The most of my patients are in US. The Indian couple, the lady is 89 and her husband is 94 or 95 years old, and they are thriving. And yeah, so I guide them through one-on-one, but I'm you know, I mean, it gets busy.
Thank you. Well, this was just a wonderful presentation. I'd love to have you back because, you know, I think you bring such a common sense approach and you're helping so many people. And that whole salad bowl thing, I'm going to think about that. You know, it's not a melting pot, it's a salad bowl. And that is just such a great, it'd be a great t-shirt too, by the way.
Yes, actually the name of the scientist or doctor is Dr. Carl Dager, Dager. He was the one who came up with that concept, but I think it I felt it fits so well with what we do, you know, the melting pot versus salad theory. So I use it in my presentation quite often, and it also makes us more mindful, aware, and aware that, you know, as a person, we have to take into all these things in you know, into consideration, because behavior change is not easy.
So. Oh, if it will, if it only was, that seems to be the biggest problem. It's not about the food and getting it delicious or teaching people that. There's not a pill for that, unfortunately.
No, there's no pill for it. But it's I tell my patients, you know, the solution is in your hand. Really, the pill is in your hand. You were born with that pill. You just have to unleash it, you know, and have that, or have the open mind to try this. And it's not a different approach either. I mean, we are asking you to eat foods that we are supposed to eat. You know, it's not like I'm asking you to breathe carbon dioxide instead of oxygen.
Nice.
So,
thank you, Deepa. This was a lovely presentation.
No problem. Thank you, Ms. Chef AJ.
Oh, my pleasure. And thanks all of you for watching another episode of Chef AJ Live. Please come back tomorrow at 11 a.m. Pacific time for Nick DeVoren and Thomas Allen for Vinegar and Spice and Everything Nice. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.